Hi there, it's Davinia here, and this season we're proud to be partnering with Nosso, an awesome new app created to help parents invest for their children's futures with the support of their close family and friends. Nosso offers investment products like junior stocks and shares ISAs, as well as general investment accounts and much more. They make gifting from family and friends super memorable with messages and photos, which means any money you gift on behalf of children has a lasting legacy. Just remember that as with all investing, your money is at risk. You can find out more about Nosso via the link in the show notes. Enjoy the episode. Hi, and welcome to the Let's Make It Rain podcast. I'm your host, Davinia Tomlinson. This podcast is for the rainmakers, those women who are breaking down walls, building their own empires, defying convention and rejecting stereotypes. Women who are unafraid to have open, honest conversations about money among friends and to share the truths we've been told to keep secret. Don't forget to subscribe, share and download wherever you usually get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, then please leave us a 5-star review. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Let's Make It Rain podcast. Today I am super pleased to be joined by Maya Mufarik. Maya is founder of strategic growth marketing consultancy Marketing Cube, which is a consultancy for startups and scale-ups. Maya is also an active angel investor. Maya, thank you so much for being here today. Why don't you introduce yourself for the benefit of the listeners?
Thank you for inviting me to join you today. I am a marketing operator. I partner with tech founders and their executive teams to define and implement their business growth path. My work is really anchored in customer insights, data, brand, and marketing. And before I started Marketing Cube, I worked with the likes of Google and American Express and Not on the High Street, very much in the digital marketing space. My last in-house role was digitizing the UK healthcare industry with Pharmacy2U, where we were bringing repeat prescription management online. It's a very much a mission-driven business, which delivers about 15% savings to the NHS in medication costs, and that's an £8 billion pound cost line for them. So not a small amount. Wow.
And Maya, you sound like, before we get into the meaty part of our conversation, you sound like you have a very international accent. Can you tell us a bit about your early upbringing and your life and where you got that accent from?
I'm a French educated kid, which eventually got the French passport, but has no French blood. And I have a Russian mother and a Lebanese father. So I'm confused sometimes.
Truly but, international.
Right. And I've chose London to be my home for the last 20 years.
Oh, lovely. So Maya, in, you know, that description that you gave of some of the different roles that you've had over the course of your career, one thing that struck me was that, you know, you talked about purpose-led or mission-led businesses, and Not on the High Street is a business that I love. I remember its earliest days and reading several of the interviews of the truly inspiring founders. How did you find yourself in that role or working with a business like that? And then how do you contrast that with working for something that's truly mission-led, I suppose, you know, trying to revolutionize digitally, if you like, the UK healthcare industry, which, as you say, is a multi-billion pound industry?
I was working at Google and kind of getting ready for leaving the company after about 6 years. And I was actually talking at a kind of Girls in STEM event where I met one of the founders of Not on the High Street. And kind of that conversation led into more and landed with me joining them after their Series A raise from Index at the time. Obviously, the kind of, you know, woman building businesses from their kitchen tables was definitely something that could resonate with me. And they really were at this inflection point where they needed to truly build their digital capabilities capabilities, their marketing capabilities, and they had a lovely brand, and the founders did such a tremendous job with PR and branding, but we were now getting into the nitty-gritty of, you know, building a great customer experience, really cutting through the noise and bringing them to more audiences. So I spent some time with them. Mussy Pharmacy to You was much later in my career and much more recent. And this was, again, I think something we kind of built from scratch by combining a bunch of things that were happening in health tech, backed by great investors that believed in it. And it was truly a kind of a first in the market move. So there was no reference points. We were building all the experience from kind of our own wild imagination and, you know, our preferences, obviously a lot of customer insights as well. But to some extent, I'm sure we all have our frustrations with the NHS and how some things should be much easier. So that was also, you know, an exceptional opportunity to make a difference. And I'm really happy to see them carry on bringing the torch throughout COVID and now and truly becoming a household name.
Mm. I mean, when you think about, obviously, the different types of businesses that you've worked with, you know, across different sectors, different stages of their development, and I guess now focus specifically on startups and scale-ups, which is what you do at Marketing Cube, what do you see as some of the things that startups in particular are getting wrong and some of the things that they're getting right as they think about scaling their businesses? You know, if you had to say these are some of the hallmarks of success on your path to scaling, what would you say some of those hallmarks are? What kind of clues should we all be looking out for?
I mean, this is obviously a very wide topic, but some of the core elements that keep on coming back, and actually if you get those right, a lot of magic can happen. So not truly knowing their target audience, you know, their context, what they're truly trying to accomplish, what anxieties they might have about trying a new solution. If you don't get that right, if you don't really get that insight, it makes it really hard to engage with that audience in a way that resonates with them and therefore cuts through. So I do spend any business I work with, I spend a lot of time here. Would it be to check that they definitely know or to invite them to go and discover more? Because that's really foundational to anything we would do after. Some of them are trying to be very clever with their messaging and are under maximizing comprehension in their copy. And, you know, as a startup, as a tech kind of innovator, you're often building something very new that needs explaining. So comprehension for me is at the forefront. You can do clever messaging later. Often being unclear about their positioning, and for those not familiar with that, positioning is a strategic exercise that defines where your product or service fits in the marketplace, but also very much in the customer lives and minds. And very importantly, also how it is distinguished from the alternatives that your customers might have. So some might equate that to defining their brand purpose. Brand purpose is really a statement that is mostly around, you know, we exist because we want to change the world in that way statement. It states that venture's positive impact in the ecosystem, which is great, but positioning is different. And it's more about what you can, and like, right? Like what is, it's much more pragmatic, much more anchored in a benefit statement for your audience. And really, if you understand that, if you understand your audience, you can articulate really where the benefit is and how that benefit truly matches the life of your audience or the struggles that they might be having. So that for me is really essential. And it's kind of almost a step-by-step that I'm giving you here of some elements to consider. And then finally, what I'm seeing is it's very unfortunate a lot of early stage ventures, although they're quite small and shouldn't have problems of like larger corporates, they're not really strongly aligned across the organization and the functions, you know? And for me, it's really getting strong alignment on venture level objectives, how the cross-functional teams contribute towards them so that they can really operate as a single growth team and not separate departments. So I think that's another one that I see a bit too often, like realigning the teams.
Yeah, I mean, it's particularly interesting to hear you talk about brand purpose and the difference or the distinction between brand purpose and positioning, because I think as somebody that spent a lot of time in various marketing departments for some of the, you know, big asset management companies, investment management firms on a grand scale, as well as some of the smaller firms, one of the things that I think the industry, and I, you know, I say financial services industry as a whole, but of course there are innumerable subsets within that, from, you know, investment banking through to retail banking, and then all of the different types of investment firm in between. And one of the things that I would say consistently remains a challenge is how to position themselves in the mind of the target audience. Mm-hmm. And then particularly now when we think about this challenge of trying to promote a sense of financial inclusion, mm-hmm. You know, who are they trying to reach? Who are the people that have been marginalized and excluded? And how can they make sure that they are communicating in a way that's accessible but non-patronizing, recognizing the different needs and challenges that different groups and different communities face, and making sure that they're able to mirror some of those challenges within their workforce so that it doesn't feel contrived or tokenistic in terms of their marketing approach. I mean, this is completely, you know, slightly tangential, but related, of course, to your expertise. I mean, for you know, when you think about the financial services industry and the challenge, I suppose, around promoting that sense of inclusion, whether it's for women, and of course that's something that's particularly close to my heart through Raincheck, but then of course there are many other communities. There are people that are differently abled, there are people that come from different ethnic minority groups in the UK, for example, and just feel this sense that, you know, the city of London, for example, is this big, intimidating, imposing beast that's not necessarily for them. What would you say to, you know, an investment management company that was trying to get more people to invest, you know, applying that, you know, almost that blueprint, if you like, around what you've talked about, you know, when it comes to positioning?
Yeah, I think, and just to touch on what you just said here, it's, you know, it's kind of the old age of, like, you know, if it's a whole male marketing team, you know, marketing to women, it's not going to work as well. If, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, I'm sure a lot of men can have a lot of empathy toward a lot of, you know, female centric topics, but still, right? Like, you kind of have to live it sometimes to really know. And so what I would say to those, you know, financial institutions is, well, start by diversifying your team, right? Start by actually having that diversity in your team. Because those insights, yes, of course, you can, you know, interview and do focus groups and do a whole bunch of stuff. But the real magic comes where people seen it, known it, been part of it, and that really then becomes reflected in your communication, in your messaging, and the moments you try to create around your community. And that becomes way more authentic. And I think that becomes really, really important for sure.
Yeah, completely agree.
So I guess the kind of the core point here is that, you know, we need to start putting diverse, you know, leadership teams in role that make decisions that impact those diverse audiences, right? Like that's I think the core of it.
Absolutely. And it's a thing that we will never stop championing, the idea that diversity shouldn't be something that you do, you know, in a vacuum, or that you do because you feel that it's, you know, it's the right thing to do, but that you don't necessarily believe. It has to be something that becomes part of the culture of the business, you know, from everything, and not just HR's problem, if you like. I mean, that's another thing, you know, when you make it the responsibility of a single department to try and fix this diversity issue, then invariably what happens is you hire in a load of people that potentially look like they could fulfill the requirements of this newly diverse organization, but then they quite quickly realize that the culture is not conducive to them succeeding or thriving, and then they all just quickly leave. So I think you're absolutely right. It really is about getting the tone from the top right and making sure that leadership is in place to facilitate, you know, the right kinds of conversations that will ultimately lead to, you know, really positive customer outcomes.
That's right.
So, I mean, obviously, your work is so expansive. I feel like we could probably chat for 3 hours, Myra, based on all of the different things that you've done. But I'm really intrigued by and interested in your angel investing. And I suppose what led you to this, you know, this, I suppose, this different facet of your career? What led you to become an angel investor?
Yeah, I mean, maybe to state the obvious, but usually angel investors are former business operators or executives who use the proceeds of their past successes to support new ventures. It is a personal investment strategy that is high risk and potentially high reward. We need to remember that only 1 in 10 startups will succeed in the long term and return meaningful rewards to their investors. So I'll let that sink in for a second. For me, it was after my exit from Pharmacy 2U, I decided to include angel investing in my investment strategy. I knew the startup world well. I had worked at different stages of a startup journey. I've been exposed to startup boardrooms and investors. So it was a natural step in my investment journey. Yet, with all new things, a major learning curve as well. So, you know, some of the ways that kind of I helped myself on that journey, I joined an angel investment community called Ventures Together. To learn really from more tenured angel investors, get more diversity into some of those groups as well. So that's really how that path led there. It felt relatively natural to start both giving back to that community. I think I'm also very passionate, in supporting female founders, anything in femtech, and plenty of other, underrepresented groups, but it felt like I had plenty to share both from my past experiences and my own element of diversity in the tech world, I guess, to that community. And they teach me plenty every day too.
So Maya, based on your experience of investing in different businesses, do you have, an inclination towards a particular type of business or sector? Mm. What are some of the things that you look for in the businesses that you back?
Sure. I mean, we all invest with our own lenses, experiences, expertise. I invest very much with a marketing and customer lens, kind of let my wider community help me DD the rest, or conduct the due diligence on the rest. Really, I need empathy with the problem that they're trying to solve, right? Like, I'm sure there was some great deals I've seen in industries I really don't understand or problems I can't empathize with, and it's just not for me because also I won't be able to help them as much, and that's really important that your angels are what we call smart money, right? Are able to help you in the path. I really look for emotional literacy, which is really this relentless focus on the end user, the customer of that business, really. Some of the things we mentioned above, do they know the team? Does the team know the customer well? Do they understand the barriers and pain points and what they're really doing to solve for them? So I want to see this true understanding of their audience. I can see, I need to see that the team will be able to deliver against their mission, or I would at least bet on them being able to deliver against their mission based on their experience, their mix of talent. Obviously, as a marketer and a growth marketer, I scrutinize their growth strategy. Sometimes, not that it needs to be fully polished, but, at least a sense of where they think they're going or possibly how it can help them refine that. And then, there's some of the basics, obviously, what is the monetization opportunity? What's the size of the market? We touched a bit on founder and product fit, is the founder trying to solve something that they experienced firsthand or not? And it can be a double-edged sword, this one, because if you become a focus group of one, you can be under the illusion of knowing the problem and the solutions, but that's a different one. And finally, it comes to corporate culture, they're going to build a business if they're going to be successful at this. So I look at their leadership style, their operating model, their ability really to create a following, both internally and externally, to help them succeed.
I mean, it's really intriguing to, the entire world of kind of venture capital, private equity, and then, of course, angel investing with individuals like you and others who are able to provide a funding lifeline to businesses right at the start of their journey when, and businesses like Raincheck, really, right when we need the money the most. And we're thinking about how to test this exciting new idea. All of us will come with this level of enthusiasm and excitement about this new idea that we have, which we think can resolve these issues. But something that you touched on that is particularly close to my heart is around culture You know, emotional literacy, mm-hmm. you talked about, you know, understanding of the problem and the extent to which you believe the founders can actually resolve some of those issues. But one of the things that we see, you know, as somebody that, you know, sits within the startup community, one of the things that we see, I guess dominating headlines are, you know, some of these giant personalities who've been able to raise millions, if not billions of dollars from some of the biggest firms in the world, irrespective of their track record. You know, perhaps they have achieved, you know, a degree of success. But then even when those businesses don't ultimately thrive, they are still backed time and time again. And we've seen a brilliant example of that with WeWork's founder. What is your view when you look at, you know, some of the funding challenges around the startup community? And again, this is slightly off topic, but I'm really interested in your perspective on this, Maya, because as somebody that, you know, ultimately, when you think about what a business is trying to do, the marketing almost occupies or sits at the heart of the kind of engine of the business, really, in kind of reaching people, thinking about those paths to cutting through all of the noise and being really distinctive in the market. And ultimately, you know, with the best, you know, with the, I guess in an ideal world, the product would absolutely match the messaging and the communications and all of the marketing that sits around it. You don't want to have beautiful marketing and then a crap product. And you will be, you know, obviously your best place to really forensically look at, are these founders really building this with the right intentions? You know, are they putting their heart into it? And how can we make sure that the marketing really matches that? But then I think for others, for people that are, you know, trying to raise funding, you know, there's a lot about the female funding gap, the ethnic minority funding gap, and all of these various challenges. When you set that against these big personalities that are able to generate millions of pounds in funding, whether it's a WeWork founder or someone else, I mean, we don't need to individualize it, but what would you say are some of the challenges that the industry is facing, and how do you think, this is really big picture, right? But how do you think that some of these challenges might be tackled?
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally, right, the diversity challenge that that starts with is the fact that the tech world in general was very male-driven, starting by the coders, and it's still, to some extent, the case. It's better than when I started several years ago, but it's still, you know, heavily male-dominated. I think in the more adjacent function within technology, like marketing and HR and some of the leadership roles too, it's a bit more diverse now. But at the core, right, it's finance, funding, a tech industry, right? I mean, for me, they're all very interconnected. And so it ends up being former business operators in tech becoming VCs, and it wasn't diverse then, it's not now, and or they're coming from banking, which has its own similar problems, right? So that's really the core of the problem, right? That's how that issue was born and amplified with time. You know, I think there's a lot of initiatives in place right now. I'd like to think that it's definitely going in the right direction, maybe not fast enough. There's plenty of initiatives really focused on that diversity. The VC industry itself has created almost like training grounds for young, diverse graduates to enter the industry. So there's definitely initiatives around that. When it comes to how, you know, some people are rewarded or not for what can be seen as a success or not, I think that, you know, comes down obviously to the story that you can tell and your connections. But also we have to remember the business models that those big VCs work under and the amount of cash that they need to deploy and how quickly. And so I think it's also intrinsic to what those events investors need to accomplish. So that's kind of the big check, big reward, big risk, right, kind of scenario that they're working with. But coming back to one thing that you said around marketing and storytelling and your narrative, and I say that's really essential, no matter kind of how well known you are in the industry or not. And that's often what I counsel some early founders that I possibly decide not to invest in, but saying, you know, what is your narrative? What is the big thing that is really transformational here? What is this big problem that you're really going to be solving? Versus there might be a hypothesis and a and a soft idea or a nice to have? What is the, like, we shouldn't have a world where type of scenario? And I think that's really important. I think a lot of them sometimes are a bit too humble, I guess, or like, well, that seems a bit too grand. I barely, you know, too grand for my story. I barely have, you know, a little amount of code here and there. And, you know, possibly one of the biggest successes of the WeWorks founder and his wife is this ability to make everything extremely grand in the way they describe it, no matter what it looks under the hood. And I'm definitely not a supporter of that, but I think some element of that bigger storytelling is essential to capture people's minds.
Yes, I completely agree. Would you say then on that basis that, and I'm trying to think of how to ask the question without it being a leading question. So when I ask it, know that the intention is not to be leading. But ultimately, what I'm really interested in, because of course, you know, all of the work that I do is in support of women. It's in support of championing, uplifting, motivating, spurring on, giving tough love to women. It's a thing that I love to do best. It's really where, you know, I do it without having to think about it. It's something that is kind of hard coded into my DNA. And so I feel, you know, the best aligned I have felt from a career perspective or from a life perspective almost was when I started working with women through Rain Check. But one of the things that it strikes me is that, you know, in this, you know, in this kind of venture, you know, new venture startup ecosystem is that, and even when it comes to women and money, you know, and having conversations with women about money and trying to coax them to embrace the idea of being a wealthy woman. What does it mean to be a wealthy woman? Recognizing that it is not one size fits all. You know, there is not, you know, a single script for how you should live your life and what it means to be a woman who has means, but that we should absolutely feel that we can lay claim to wanting to build wealth for a multitude of different reasons. And they don't all have to be about investing in community or investing in family or having children. That might be part of our story, but there are a number of other stories too. But there is definitely a level of hesitancy that comes from women. And I wonder, back to my original point, how that plays out in a VC or in an angel investing world. You know, when you see pitches from female founded businesses, are you seeing women appearing less shy, slightly more bashful when it comes to talking about this grand plan? Are we too conservative compared to the men? What's your view?
I think we kind of, that point has been made a lot of times now, and I feel like women have, you know, accepted that they have a tendency to not brag as much as you know, other communities, and therefore I think they have now embraced the fact that they need to relook at what they're saying and feel more empowered to be a bit more boastful about things. I've definitely invested in quite a few female founders now. I think all of their decks were quite strong. There was definitely a really, we're better storytellers usually though. So definitely. I think that plays, right? So that I think plays to their advantage.
We're so compelling.
Right. Compared to like some other decks I've seen. And I'm like, can you put this into a sentence for me? So in that sense, less so. No, I don't think, I think that like, we've gone you know, we've done a fair bit around that by now. I think, you know, we kind of, and I catch myself too, relooking at something saying, well, is that like putting it softly, or can I be a bit more strong about this point or that point or that accomplishment? So not as much anymore, but it's definitely something that people have been working on, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's super interesting, and you're quite right. It is something that comes up time and time again. And actually, there are a number of rainmakers who resist any of these stereotypes very strongly, because from their perspective, they're like, you know, Dav, I don't feel that I lack confidence, and I don't feel that, you know, I have a problem speaking up. It's just when I do speak up, the people that I'm speaking up to don't necessarily receive the message in the way that I would like, or they don't hear me in the way that I would want them to. So yeah, I suppose there are way more factors than just whether or not a woman feels confident in telling stories. But exactly as you say, we are easily no bias at all, the most interesting and compelling storytellers. So certainly when it comes to that particular point about building a strong narrative and having the courage of our convictions, I would say that we absolutely have that in abundance. So that's a really good thing. Yeah. So Maya, when it comes to, you know, given the topic of this podcast, when we think about, you know, you and your wealth building and your relationship with money, how would you describe your personal relationship with money, and has it evolved over time?
Yeah, I think my relationship with money was very much shaped by my upbringing and specifically by my father. The first thing I remember learning about money was from him. He used to say to me and my brothers when we were still teens, and like all teens wanted 100 different gadgets and things, we are not rich enough to buy cheap stuff, not to use other words. And, you know, what he meant by that is that, you know, buy a small amount of quality things that might be a little more pricey, but will last you. And you need to be extremely rich to be constantly buying a humongous amount of things that are just like transient constantly. And it's like, you know, you keep on spending on stuff that basically have no value and you don't really use or just break, as you know, very easily. So that's kind of that space where, you know, and not that he was encouraging us to, you know, be really rich and be wasteful either, but there was this element of like, you know, he was self-made, financial security was something that really understood. And so he was kind of anchoring his advice in that, right? So that's, you know, I think that's how my first lessons around money really started. And I think it stayed out. It's, you know, not being wasteful, now also not being wasteful for the sake of our planet, to be honest, right? So I think it's it kind of comes full circle. It wasn't particularly the topic in the 80s. It should have been, I guess. And then for him also, wealth is only wealth if it's multi-generational. And he definitely has taught that to me and my brothers. And like he did for us, he always encouraged us to consider how to build kind of the next foundations, I guess, for our own children and the way we manage our investments and the way we would educate them about money. But again, it was very much based on the fact that he was completely self-made, came from almost nothing. And so that's really that relationship with money where, you know, kind of financial security is really important, and it's something that you build for yourself and the next generations in mind.
I love that, Maya. First of all, I love that expression, we are not rich enough to buy cheap things. I love that, because I think an equivalent expression is something like buy cheap, buy twice. But I love the way your dad put it.
I guess that would be brilliant. That would be the proper English expression.
I love your dad's way of
translation
saying it. But also this idea of, and it's a thing, and I, you know, I don't want to generalize or stereotype. I mean, this would be a happy stereotype, but certainly when I have conversations with people that come from certain communities or backgrounds, you know, I've had guests on who come from Caribbean culture, African culture, Middle Eastern, you know, a variety of different cultures. But the thing that I find that is in common with people that come from backgrounds that are non-Anglo is that there is something about intergenerational wealth and passing it down through generations. You know, whether the start point, you know, was a wealthy background, or whether, as in your dad's case, the elders in the community had come from nothing and were building that wealth up. And then, of course, you know, there's a real focus on preserving that wealth through generations and making sure that there is something to pass forward to the next generation. I'm really interested in this topic, if you like, around how it impacts the people that, you know, as each generation goes forward, how exactly is that message interpreted, and how does it influence the way that each of us live our lives? Does it make us more more joy-filled in our day-to-day existence? Does it make us more careful with money, more frugal? Does it mean that we are, you know, almost in paying homage to the people that have come before us in saying, you know, they've had to work so hard so that we could have an easier life. And so on that basis, we really want to lean into, you know, as we talked about before this podcast began, about you having a soft August and maybe, you know, giving yourself permission to take a bit of a break. You know, of course, it manifests itself so differently in each of us individually. How would you say, you know, on a day-to-day basis, this idea of, I guess, intergenerational wealth and preserving what you have for future generations, how does it play out for you on a almost a day-to-day basis, would you say?
I mean, it comes into so many formats. I think my, you know, one of my dad's life accomplishments or my parents' life accomplishment by now has been, you know, some of kind of their the happy place they built for themselves in Portugal, where we spend a lot of time too and we love. So that will become something that we will maintain, right? That will be a way that, you know, we show this reverence to what they built and what they gave us, and that kind of passing in the generations, right? And if I think of, I think passing this on, because obviously, you know, as you build generational wealth, you come to a point, and I think about that a lot for my daughter, where, well, they haven't, you know, yes, of course, they'll see my hard work and the hard work of her husband, her father, and many other things, and we will tell, and you know, she knows her grandparents, and I hope they'll be around for very long for her to hear the stories directly. But you know, at some point she will have been brought up in a, you know, in a very comfortable life and surrounded, you know, with exposure to so many things and access to things that I didn't have access when I was her age. And so how do you make sure that when maybe they haven't experienced or seen it for themselves, they know exactly where it came from and and how long it took to get there, right? So I think that's something that we definitely look at a lot. And part of that wealth, I think, is that history and that storytelling. Again, coming back to that and really telling those stories. And so I'm really keen, I know, to record my own parents with their own stories that maybe I've heard 100 times now, but to keep them in the family.
Oh, I love that. And I guess as somebody who, like you, has daughters, you know, I think it's particularly powerful, not just, you know, whether you have daughters or sons, you know, it's particularly powerful to kind of preserve the family heritage and to, you know, preserve those stories. But also, you know, as you were describing, the things that you're able to expose your daughter to, very similar to me and the things that I'm able to expose my daughter to in comparison with what I was exposed to at their age. It's trying to strike this balance between making sure that, you know, each generation does slightly better and that they see new things and they're exposed to new things and new experiences, but at the same time there is that sense of gratitude and appreciation for those opportunities that's almost baked in to their existence too. So yeah, no, I love that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Maya, just going back to your angel investment experience, because you've invested in our podcast partner, Nosso, which is a business that I personally love. And I think, you know, anybody that knows me and particularly that's part of the Rainmaker community, they'll hear me say all the time, I don't do partnerships. I don't do collaborations. I'm not an influencer. I love influencers. I follow many influencers on Instagram, but I'm not an influencer. Raincheck is a business that I'm building very much from the bottom up, and I want it to be this thriving global community. But, you know, on that basis, you know, I'm very careful about who I will introduce the Rainmakers to, who they see me, you know, quote unquote, backing, because I don't want to be responsible for the narrative, if you like, that, you know, another company puts out there when we are trying to build one of our own.
Yeah.
That said, Nosso is a business that I love personally, and I know that it's one that you financially backed. So I suppose for anybody listening, Nosso is effectively a brand new app that enables parents, godparents, grandparents to save and invest on behalf of the children in their lives, which I think is brilliant. And of course, I have a vested interest in something like this because, you know, as we've just said, you know, both Maya and I are mothers of daughters. And so it's something that I'm particularly passionate about. But Maya, in your case, what was it about Nosso that compelled you to invest?
Yeah, I mean, everyone, I think by now in the investment, or at least in the investment community, agrees, but also anyone interested in investing will have heard, you know, the term, the power of compound interest, right? And so imagine if your children could benefit from having an investment plan to their name from day one, right? As opposed to from when they're 20 years old. So that's 20 years of missed opportunity. And so that was kind of one thing that was really interesting to me. And then the other one is, I just got bored of saying, before even, you know, because my daughter is only three now, but, you know, I would see those wasteful 30 plastic boxes of toys post-birthday parties and things like that. And then when I had my, you know, from my friend's kids' parties. And then as soon as I had my daughter, you know, grandparents desperately looking for meaningful ways, you know, to contribute to their grandchildren's education. And there's only so many scooters and prams that a grandparent can buy, right? Like, so at some point it becomes really, you know, heavy. And so NOSO are here really to offer this investment pot for your children. You know, you open an investment account where you, your family, your friends can all invest into the fund of your little one for kind of the small moments or the big moments of their life. And for me, I think that's priceless. Kind of, you generate this unique URL where you're like, contribute whatever you like here. And so it just becomes so easy. It's birthdays, it's for whatever reason, and you know that money goes into an investment pod that you curate and you manage, etc. And so everyone is building, talking of multi-generational wealth, right? Like straight mm-hmm. into the benefit of those children, on top of anything else that you might choose to leave for them later. But for me, that was like just so necessary and so painful in general, even in your day to day, but also just the right thing to do by your child from day one.
Mm. I love it. I love it for exactly the reasons that you've outlined. And I remember, you know, before becoming a mom myself, having godchildren and always, you know, on their birthdays, giving their parents cash. Yes. Of course, yes. Giving the presents too, even though exactly as you described, their parents, you know, my friends in particular would be like, oh gosh, that please don't buy anything. They've got so much stuff. And of course I'm like, no, but I'm the fairy godmother. I've got to buy all the things. And so now as a mother and getting all that stuff and thinking, oh my gosh, like A, the plastic, but B, like they outgrow this stuff so quickly and they just don't play with it anymore. But knowing that you're in a position to gift in a really efficient way through an app like this is just genius. So yeah. I love NOSO too. So Maya, back to, you know, your own kind of money making decisions and, you know, thinking about some of the investment decisions that you've made for yourself. What would you say has been your best financial or investment decision and what has been your worst, if you have one?
Yeah, I'm not sure you can call that an investment decision per se. When I joined Google and obviously got, you know, at the time Google and still is getting, you know, gives stock incentives to their employees, obviously that made some, you know, really good returns. Mm-hmm. So I think Brilliant. That was maybe my first investment decision to some extent, although it was a job too. But yes. It's definitely, you know, kind of at least, you know, keeping them or selling them at the right time also helped. And, you know, arguably I continue to be overexposed in tech stock in my kind of stock portfolio today. And it definitely has built wealth as well. Worst investment, not sure. My angel journey is a bit young, so I'm sure there'll be plenty of worse decisions to share in a few years. But more of a missed opportunity. I kind of pondered buying some Tesla stock a few years ago, and I don't know, I think most probably just got distracted and never properly did it. And that's definitely a massive missed opportunity. That would have been a really good investment.
Yeah, no, that's a good way to contextualize it, actually. Missed opportunities as well. Yeah, brilliant example. So Maya, when we talk about investing at Raincheck, you know, one of the things that I always say to the Rainmakers is that we are, each of us, our biggest investment by far. Because I think, you know, in this, particularly if you are in any way following, I don't know, personal finance accounts on social media, you know, investment accounts, wealth management accounts, there's all this talk about net worth, how you build your net worth, how you increase your assets, reduce your liabilities. And I know that, you know, working in groups on a one-to-one basis with the Rainmakers, there are a number of women who will say to me, oh my God, Dav, I'm in negative net worth. I've got no assets. It's terrible. And I always remind them, you know, everything that you do, in fact, even the example that you've just described, Maya, about, you know, joining Google and maybe not joining there thinking I'm going to get some brilliant stock options that will build wealth in future. You join there because probably you thought, oh, this is exciting and it's Google and I'm going to be exposed to some amazing things and projects and opportunities. And as a result of, you know, that taking that decision, you know, in many ways, it's an investment in yourself, you know, and in your learning and professional development. Outside of that Google example, you know, what would you say has been your biggest investment in yourself, and how has it transformed you?
Yeah, I think the biggest transformation was possibly founding Marketing Cube and running my own consultancy and growth venture. It's obviously a massive, you know, transition from being an employee to being self-employed and running your own shop. And it's also a massive opportunity to learn and just, you know, do a very different mind gym every day beyond obviously everything that I do that I still did before around, you know, thinking about marketing and audiences and how to grow a business, but around growing your own business as well, right? So I think that was possibly the biggest transformation. Completely agree with you. Investing in yourself is key and important. And you know, every single kind of day and minute of the time, especially for a mom, is accounted for. So I definitely have battled with that for time, mostly not because I didn't want to do it. I've ended up kind of booking monthly personal development days in my calendar. So it's like a day off that you take for yourself, but just to focus on, you know, reading, you know, your reading list that you've never got to, listening to some podcast, maybe even taking a training course on an adjacent topic that you're passionate about. So I think also just allocating time to that and really not canceling it, I guess, because there's always something, you know, more pressing to do possibly, has been another way that I definitely invest in myself and focus on that. So that, you know, that's kind of some of the things that this topic brings up for me.
Maya, I absolutely love the personal development days. And I love, I particularly love that you mentioned the reading list, because I cannot tell you the number of books. In fact, I will order books the second that I read an excellent book review of anything. And I particularly love fiction. But, you know, of course, I read the business books as well for my professional development. But anytime I see a book that looks interesting, I buy it. The stack of books that I've got to read, I've had to put calendar entries in that say read one chapter for like all these different books, otherwise I'm never going to get through them. So it's brilliant to hear you say that, and super inspiring.
You might need a reading week
I do yeah. But I mean, that brings me on to my next and I guess final question before the quick fire round, which is you know, of course, Rain Check is really about helping women build sustainable long-term wealth, and I suppose give themselves permission to even think about what it might mean to be a wealthy woman and to live life completely unapologetically and on their own terms. But what does it mean to be wealthy to you? I mean, you've touched on it in one way. I mean, that's would be one of my examples, which is having the freedom to you know, take a day to do some things that enrich me. But, you know, what does it mean to be wealthy to you? And actually, has it changed for you, you know, over the years at different, you know, different points in your life?
Yeah. I mean, wealthy for me is doing work that I love. And on top of providing for my family, it is also just energizes me more than it drains me. I think that that becomes essential because we spend so many hours doing that. And so I think it's really important for me, at least, to start with that. Being able to flex my work and clients around my life, right, without compromising on the quality of the work I do or the quality of the opportunities I'm given, has definitely become more important as I became a mother. And I'm really grateful to be able to do that. And then another maybe very mommy comments on this one, I have to say, not feeling guilty when work life or family life needs to urgently take over or unexpectedly take over one day, you know, because something happened on one end or the other. I think that really creates an element of like well-being and, you know, human wealth, I guess, that is really important to me.
I absolutely love that. And it's something that over the last few years, I've been trying to cultivate in myself so that, I mean, I suppose there's two things that you said that I particularly love. The one is about doing work that energizes and not drains you. And one of the things that I would always say, and it's something that I remember from one of my favorite companies that I've worked for prior to setting up Rain Check. And the founder of that company always used to say, be a radiator, not a drain. And he said, you know, he used to say that he would seek to hire people that embodied that ethos. So, you know, they were a pleasure to be around. They uplifted, you know, they had that kind of cheerleading spirit versus, you know, those people that just drain the life out of you. And I've always remembered that because it's just such a brilliant and succinct way of encapsulating the energy that you want to have every day. So I loved that you said that. But also, you know, just this idea, this sense of not feeling guilty. I mean, I can't imagine how how many calories women burn, mothers or non-mothers even, just people, you know, as women moving through the world and feeling responsible for everything, responsible for our own feelings and everybody else's feelings and well-being. And actually just putting down that bag, putting down the load and saying, you know, as long as my child is well-loved, well-cared for and knows those things, then she's fine. And I don't have to be guilty for doing the work that energizes me. So I love that you said that.
Mine is convinced that she has to let me go to work so I can get her slime. So, you know.
Did you say not? Slime? Oh my gosh.
Slime, yeah.
Yeah, I that know, stuff. Yeah. So messy, so gross. Maya, thank you so much. I'm now going to move on to our quick fire questions. I'm going to pick three at random.
Sure.
So what's one money lesson you learned early on that you swear by?
Do not spend what you do not have for your everyday. Borrowing to leverage an investment is a different matter.
Love that. If you were hosting a dream dinner party, who would be there and why? Outside of family and friends.
Yeah. So Serena Williams' former coach is called Patrick Mouratoglou. And I attended a very unique resilience masterclass by him last year. And I would love to hear more about his wisdom and accomplished in greatness. And he just comes across as just a wonderful human being. So I'm sure there's more to him than just resilience training.
He sounds dreamy. And yes, I've read quite a lot about him as well.
Yes, he's wonderful. Yeah.
Okay. And my third question, finish this sentence. Anyone that knows me would be surprised that secretly I am what?
Oh, secretly. People don't tend to know I'm an avid photographer, but it's maybe not so much of a secret anymore.
Oh.
Secret. I have secret dance parties with my three-year-old in our living room and we blast pop music.
Okay, what's the music? So you blast pop music. Does your three-year-old have a favorite song?
Gosh. No, I don't think she has one. She just wants to see that the Spotify image shows someone dancing because she thinks she feels that gives her permission to dance or something, or that's the right playlist. I don't know. No, she doesn't have that.
That is brilliant. I know about those secret dance parties too. We have them regularly in my household. Maya, thank you so much for your time today. Where can people find you if they'd like to find out more?
I'm quite active on LinkedIn. So if you're a startup or a scale up or looking for a side hustle, I think some of my content on LinkedIn might be helpful to you, and otherwise on marketingcube.co.
Brilliant. Thank you so much again and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.
Hi everyone, Davinia here. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. If any of what you heard resonated and you'd like to find out more about how Raincheck is helping women all over the world build sustainable long-term wealth, then visit our website at raincheck.com and join the mailing list for more commentary, tips and opinion on how you can start taking steps to leveling up your financial well-being today. You can follow us on social media at Raincheck, and don't forget to share, like, rate, review and subscribe. See you next time. Thank you.